Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 10. Coming up on this show, we've got the Dreamscape Manipulators, the Crystal Meth Reptilian Connection, and the Ancient Bloodlines and their New World Order. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I did not see the Crystal Meth Reptilian Connection coming today, but when it hit me, it was like a train wreck. This is a crazy story that I'm going to be getting into a
sounds
little bit later.
Like, it sounds like my segment and yours could be connected. I'm going to be talking about Ancient Bloodlines that... A new world order.
Well, this kind of crystal, is along those lines.
Crystal meth taking reptilians?
Well, no, they're not taking it. They're pushing it upon humanity.
Oh, so it's like Breaking Bad, but
Instead
of Jesse and Walt Whitman, we've got reptilians.
It kind of comes back to this wild, spiritual war that was researched by Barbara Bartholik. And I knew a little bit about Barbara's research in the UFO field, but I hadn't really dived deep into some of her theories and some of her work. And wow, it's incredible. She managed to ingratiate her way into secretive cults. Mm. And she got involved with the Heaven's Gate cult. She found out some really incredible information about this spiritual war, which apparently is being raged upon humanity. Now, look, I'm reluctant to immediately jump into the belief that there's some type of spiritual or energetic war that's going on. But when you combine it with a number of other people's experiences, you do see a trend start to emerge.
And the trend is a spiritual war.
Yes. Yeah. Pretty much, which suggests that there is a secretive non-human intelligence or group that is trying to control humanity, which does ultimately tie back into what you're going to be describing, Ben. So where did you end up going today?
I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Today was tough.
I don't know why.
How many books did I read today? 4 or 5? Until I finally landed on what I'm going to talk about. That's always the sign that it's been a good day when you've got a pile of dead books at your feet.
Well, I think you were telling me about a book about the Birdmen, and I thought, oh, Birdmen.
Yeah, I started looking at Michael Abrams' book, Birdmen, Batman, and the Skyflyers. He wrote this in 2006, and he was at a skydiving competition where they come in and they've got to skim along a lake. It was in New York somewhere.
Mm.
They skim along a lake and they've got to land on a target that's floating in the water. And there's points and, scores for how well they do.
Do they have a wingsuit? Is that how it works?
No, this is before anyone really knew about wingsuits. And they do this very tricky maneuver to come in really low. And they've got to obviously just kind of skim the water. And he was amazed at this, and he was talking to all the skydivers after the competition, and they said, this is nothing. There's a guy that's been flying around in a wingsuit that he built himself, and he's trying to sell them.
So this is the Birdman, because obviously when you think of Birdman, you think of cryptids.
This is the story of the guy that didn't invent the wingsuit. I think he's a Finnish guy, and his parents were worried about him when he was young because he would always just jump off the roof of the house for fun.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah,
they kind of just thought, okay, well, let's not discourage his passion. So they kind of let him do this. And eventually he teamed up with a guy who designed suits for skydivers. And when he was in business himself, he was actually developing ultra-fast parachutes.
Right.
So the smaller you make the parachute, the faster it'll go.
Well, obviously, because there's less resistance.
Yeah, and at the time, I think the standard size was like 300-something. I can't remember the exact...
It can't be bigger.
300 feet. That doesn't make sense. Maybe it's 30 feet. Must have been 30 feet.
That's
and
right.
He shrunk it down to less than half of that just to go faster. So he teamed up with this other guy that was making these slim suits for skydivers, and they thought, why don't we just take my idea for the ultra-fast parachute and we'll stick it on the suit? And it's funny hearing his story because these guys that invented those modern wingsuits you see today, when they first tested them, he basically said to the journalist, Michael Abrams, the author, look, when we jumped, we had a 50% chance of making it. We just thought to ourselves, we've got a 50-50 chance of coming out of this alive. And they said, technically we know this is going to work, but everyone before us who's tried this is dead.
So I wouldn't be going with 50-50. I think the odds are probably not going to be in your favor. Right? If everyone else previously has died.
Well, they did it. And everything worked as planned except for one thing.
Which was?
It was so amazing. He said it was so unbelievably addictive and so much better than just regular skydiving.
Well, you're flying, technically. He, I mean, you're falling, but...
Absolutely hooked. And the whole story of how they got the idea is they were about to go on, I think, a base jump or something. And they saw in a cafe a photo of this guy. I can't remember his name, but he was the actual inventor of wingsuits. He took, like, some exotic material and made some construction where it kind of flaps open in the wind. And he actually did, I think, like 20 or 30 actual jumps in this prototype wingsuit. And they saw this photo of him, and that's how they got the idea. But they didn't realize that he had died in one of these, in an accident with his wingsuit only a couple of weeks after they saw the photo. But they just went with it, and they started going to like jump sites in Austria and around Europe. And initially they were banned. Like, they weren't allowed to. He said, the inventor said, if he ever even mentioned the word wingsuit, he would be kicked out of the area. He'd be kicked out of the club. He wouldn't be able to jump. He wasn't allowed to jump with his wingsuit. He had to basically break the law to show people that you could actually jump with this thing. And he said, anyone who wants to try it, I'll pay for your jump. And then if you really like it, you can buy the suit. And that's how he got started. And everyone got addicted to it because it was so, so much fun. And it actually doubles the amount of time you stay in the air compared to regular skydiving. It slows you down on descent and you're just cruising through the clouds, and people just loved it. But the book is going past this guy's initial story. It's about the whole history of birdmen jumping off like cathedrals in the 16th century.
Yeah, there's a guy in maybe the 18th or 19th century that jumped off the Eiffel Tower.
He's the famous one. Everyone knows that guy.
And he's dead.
He's got, they're all dead, dude. Every single one of them died. Basically, they would have... that guy's got like a box over his head with fabric on it.
I can see the image, yes.
But he just goes through like 13th century accounts, 14th century accounts, and it's just like French guy after Italian guy after French guy, one German guy. Actually, the Germans don't do it too much. It's mostly the French and Italians. They're just like dropping like a rock. And the best ones is when there's an entire crowd. It's like Giuseppe Bongiorno or something has announced to all of Naples that he's going to jump off the cathedral with his wingsuit, that this time is definitely going to work. And there's thousands of people. And the reports you have are just like, well, he flew like a bird, but it was more like a chicken. He just went straight down, broke his neck and died.
Wouldn't you think, though, I mean, I know it's the 16th century, so mannequins aren't easy to come by, but wouldn't you create something that looks enough like a replica of a human being, put a bit of weight in it, and then test it?
Well, they did
push that off the cathedral first?
They did this. They did all these tests. He's got stories of one of the earliest accounts is a Chinese emperor who tested his on prisoners. Like, he would hook them up to kites and basically send them up in the air.
And would they fly?
No, they all died except for one guy, and his reward was he got thrown back in prison. And there's all these very early accounts that can't be true, because if you look at the modern ones from the 17th century onwards, none of them survive. But there's accounts from like the Middle Ages where a guy is locked in a tower and, you know, the guards look up and just see this bird man flying from his prison tower over the castle and into the forest and escaping.
What, in some kind of contraption or a steampunk device?
He apparently stole wood and a bunch of sheets and made like a...
Maybe he did.
Maybe he
made a really rudimentary paraglider and it was just aerodynamic enough that it worked.
Well, apparently there's a couple of references to it, but the story goes that he couldn't mask his scent. So within an hour, the dogs had basically tracked him down and he was locked in the tower again. But the guards were so impressed by his stunt, they were like, okay, do it again. And so they made him get his wingsuit again, or whatever he had made, his stupid wings, and jump out of the tower again just so they could see it.
And he died?
Well, apparently because he was so tired from the earlier pursuit, he didn't go as far, and he landed right next to like the executioner's pit, and the guards were like, well, I guess that's a serendipity. So they executed him. Poor guy.
Oh, wow. Talk about bad
luck. He was probably a murderer or a rapist.
Oh, well, then, yeah. Well, that's not so bad.
Whatever. But the problem with the book and sharing it with you on the show, like, it sounds kind of funny and exciting, but it just got repetitive because it was just Italian guy after French guy, like Giuseppe and bloody Pierre, dropping to their death, and not much variation.
Guy jumped, guy dead.
The best one was the guy And he was the smartest out of all of them, is this Italian guy. And he just called the entire district to come and see him. And thousands of people showed up and they're all like staring at him. He's on top of this huge cathedral. And he, at the last minute, he chickens out and he says, the thing that you're all worthy of is seeing my face, and that is all you need. And then he stepped down because he didn't want to do it.
Right.
Smartest guy in history.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just too kind of repetitive. So I thought, you know, on that trend, I'll look into some more history stuff. So I looked at this book from Mikey Robbins. You know, the Queen passed away last week. Was it this week? It was this week, wasn't it? Mikey Robbins wrote this book called Reprehensible, The Polite Histories of Bad Behavior.
Oh, is this the Australian author?
Is he Australian?
I think he's Australian. Yeah, he's an Australian, like he used to be a comedian, I think. I've read some of his other work.
Yeah, it's a good book. It's funny. It's mostly just like royal orgy stories. Like, remember it was on a Plus show. I was talking about Catherine de' Medici and when she married, what was it? She first got married with the young prince. And they were worried that he wouldn't consummate the marriage. So they actually sent the prince's uncle or something to observe them in the bedroom.
Oh, yes, yes.
And he was in these official letters from, you know, hundreds of years ago of him going, well, they put in a spirited effort each and plenty of thrusts all around.
Coitus was interrupted.
And we were just like, how could you perform with your uncle in the room cheering you on? But apparently that was very common. There was four or five examples of that.
Yeah, I heard rumors that I think King Louis the 14th, 15th, I don't know, 16th, whatever. But the French used to, like, the king and queen would have sex in front of people. It was like this thing where people could watch them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how true that is. But there's another account where, again, it was like a young king and queen. And I think it was the queen or the king's mother was worried because he was so young, she was worried that whether he'd perform the deed. So she sent his uncle or his older brother to go, not his older brother, but his uncle or something to go and observe. And he's actually, again, it's like through letters, we know what took place in this consummation of the marriage. And he's like, this guy, the uncle's like, it was bizarre. He, fully erect, introduced himself to the queen, then inserted himself and froze for about 2 minutes, then withdrew without ejaculation, still erect, and then bid his queen goodnight. So what was that? And this guy's like, what was that?
But hang on, how awkward would it be for everyone involved for someone to stand there inserted for 2 minutes?
Yeah, I think this guy was spying through like a little hole or something. I don't think he was actually in the room, but that's what he reported.
I don't even know what to think of that.
It's bizarre. Why would you do that? Why would you?
So this is awkward. Seen any good movies recently? Yes,
I bid you good night. That was rather pleasurable. And he didn't even thrust. He just like was in there and then paused for a solid 2 minutes.
Do I park it in here?
Then just left with a full erection. So that it didn't really work out because it was too lewd. I didn't want to just, that's more of a plus thing. I might do it later.
That's definitely a plus thing.
Then I looked into Cosmic Codes by Dr. Chuck Missler, who decodes the Bible. So he goes through the Hebrew and there's this thing called cryptographic spacing where you're taking letters, then counting lines and it's spelling out secret messages.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Too schizo.
But it's also very much open to interpretation and it's
too schizo.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do something history. This is the whole thing. It was all building up to something history. So
you're in a history mood today.
I picked up Christopher Knight and Alan Butler's 2014 book because I love these guys. Fantastic authors.
Easily, where do we know them from?
Easily in my top five. I think the last time we spoke about their work was the book God's Blueprint, where they go through the relationships between the heavenly bodies and...
Oh, yes, of course.
...match that with the you know, the measurements of the human body. Mm-hmm. And their argument is that the entire solar system and the Earth is kind of set up for human life. It's like a very... They're bringing back this... it's not heliocentric, but what's the word for an Earth-centric view of the cosmos?
Oh, I can't remember off the top of my head, but yeah, I get it.
It's kind of like it was really interesting. And then Civilization One, they did as well. Remember?
That's it. Yes.
How the cubit and the yard and the foot all go back to ancient forms of measurement that have perfect relationships to, for example, the distance of the Earth to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's showing that there was clearly some ancient civilization that had these units of measurement, and they understood immense distances and the circumference of the Earth, and they had all this astronomical knowledge.
Any modern technology or capability?
Well, they might have had modern technology, but it's been lost. Mm. And they also did before the pyramids, another kind of ancient archaeology thing. So they're brilliant writers, and they've got this book I've never read before called The Haram Key Revisited, A Plan for a New World Order. I was like, oh, that sounds kind of conspiratorial and, yeah,
very
current.
Now.
So I wanted to go through this, and it's a bit of a Sunday school lesson, but it does diverge in an interesting way from what we know, or what you should know from, your biblical history. So they point out that the Bible has all these references to God speaking to and directing figures like Noah, Enoch, Abraham, for example. But it's generally accepted, they say, by biblical scholars that these are traditions speaking about a variety of deities. And it wasn't until later when the people who came about that wrote down the Old Testament, they kind of took all these deities and they rolled them together into one God.
So you mean it went from polytheistic to monotheistic?
Right. They just rolled it all together. And of these stories, the earliest account is of Yahweh, and this is around 3,500 years ago. Yahweh appears on Earth, and he's this tribal deity of this small clan of metalworking people who live in the mountains of the Sinai Peninsula. And it's this remote, inhospitable place. There's not many resources. There's just some precious stones and minerals. And apparently this tribe, they're like stone workers. They're miners, and they work with metals. And they have this great skill as kind of artisans. They work with bronze. And they're known as the Kenites. They took their name from the belief that they were descended from Cain, the son of Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And their god was Yahweh. So Yahweh, you know, we think of Yahweh now as this, you know, the god of the Judaic religions. But Yahweh for them was a storm deity of the mountains. He was like Thor.
Mm.
And he was the storm deity of Mount Sinai. So you can imagine one day these Kenites, they're these isolated tribesmen, there's not very many of them, they look out into the desert and they see this endless column of strangers heading towards them. And these strangers appear and explain how they've escaped from captivity in Egypt. They've crossed right through the waters of the river Nile. And under the leadership of an 80-year-old ex-army general called Moses, they've arrived. It's the Jews. Yeah. They've come out of nowhere. Now, these Kenites, they know Moses, though. He's familiar to them because he had originally been a clean-shaven general in the Egyptian army, but he had committed a murder and gone on the run in the Sinai Desert, and he ended up marrying the daughter of this high priest, who was a leader of the Kenites. So he was essentially part of their tribe. So Moses and his brother Aaron, they had also been initiated into the priesthood of the Kenites, and they had begun to worship their god, which was this storm god of the mountain, Yahweh. So let's keep going with the story. This will be very familiar to most of you. At some point, Moses leaves his people for a while. He climbs the mountain. He has a meeting with the god of the storms, Yahweh, and Yahweh gives him instructions for life, and that's eventually the story we get of the Ten Commandments. So Moses announces that his mobile nation is to continue its journey, so he takes the Kenite god, somehow takes the god from the mountain in the specially constructed box, the Ark of the Covenant. And the plan is to head in this vaguely northeasterly direction in search of this land that this god that's now in a box has promised them. The problem is the land they're going into already has hundreds of tribes of Canaanites who already live there quite happily and peacefully. Now, we recently spoke about the Ark of the Covenant on Plus Show, didn't we?
Yes.
Because I'm so tired, I totally forget the book we were talking about. I think it was by, the guy's name was Montauk.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of the book though. I'll put it in the show notes. And he spoke about all these legends regarding the Ark of the Covenant of how it would just clear a pathway in front of the Israelites. Like it would blast away scorpions and snakes. It could move mountains. It could destroy walls. Well, this is mentioned a little bit here by Knight and Butler. The box, obviously the Ark is Egyptian. It's got the two gold covered effigies of winged sphinxes on the top. And when God had conversations with Moses, when this storm God had conversations, the voice of this deity would emanate from the box. It's like he would actually talk. And this band of Hebrew escapees from Egypt, they continue their journey with their box safely, their God safely inside this box. And Yahweh would basically set the pace of how quickly they would move through the landscape. So when he wanted them to slow down, he would make the ark really heavy. And when he wanted them to speed up, he would make the ark really light.
Oh.
So it was like this kind of accelerator pedal.
Yeah.
He would control them. And as they traveled through the desert, the ark was carried 2,000 cubits over half a mile ahead of the main party. And like we discussed on that Plus show, the ark and the God locked inside it, he was pretty grumpy.
Yes, he was very angry.
And there's stories of like priests giving the box the wrong look. Like if you woke up on the wrong side of the bed and you're like, oh, I got to pick up that bloody box again.
They're getting ignited.
You would get ignited into a ball of flame. You would be destroyed. Like an arc bolt of lightning would come out of it and fry you on the spot.
Indiana Jones style.
Someone would have to come up with a dustpan and brush and just sweep you up, and that's it. And this happened time and time again. Once, for example, Moses' nephew used a non-approved source to ignite a fire to offer a burned sacrifice, and Yahweh immediately consumed them with a bolt of flame fired from inside the box. And priests had to handle it in a very special way. On the other show we spoke about this, there's the special tabernacle, which was this tent with a special kind of five layers of unique lining to keep the energy inside. Like, it's very, very strange what was going on with this ark, but that's aside the point of the show. Anyway, this group led by Moses and later his successor Joshua, they head into the land of Canaan. And when they arrive in this land of innocent people, happily living their lives, they set about destroying every township they come across, take all the food and water supplies for themselves, and then kill everyone.
Ouch.
It's a benevolent storm god in this box.
Well,
it's been locked away. And this includes quotes from the Bible where they like take all the cities, kill the men, kill the women, kill the children, leave none to remain. The only thing they took left alive for themselves were the cattle, which they obviously ate later and took all the spoils of the city. More than four centuries later, Yahweh's chosen people come to the holy city of Jerusalem, which is eventually surrendered to David, the king of the Israelites. It's claimed that David took 30,000 men to escort the ark and its divine contents to their new capital. And to make this final journey, Yahweh's mobile home was placed on a new cart drawn by Uzzah and Ahio. And as the cart journeyed onwards, Uzzah accidentally invaded Yahweh's personal space and died instantly in a ball of flame.
Wow.
I would love that power. That would be a great power. Just if you're in my space, you just ignite. If you look at me wrong, you ignite.
I don't think that's such a good idea. A lot of people would die.
Yes. So David was livid with this deity and decided to go no further. But eventually he basically cut a deal with the storm god that's in this Egyptian box. And the deal is, okay, look, we'll keep moving. You promise you're not going to turn anyone into a ball of flame, and what I'm going to do is sacrifice an ox every six paces. And the god's like, that is satisfactory.
Wait. Every six paces?
Yeah.
Six steps he takes, he's got to kill an ox.
Every six steps, they got to slaughter an ox to keep this storm god in a box happy. And they have to dance. They have to play little flutes and dance around. Otherwise, it's going to get upset. This is not a benevolent, all-loving god. This is like, it's like a djinn trapped in a box.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like an evil spirit trapped in a box. Anyway, on arrival at Jerusalem, David decides to build a temple for this angry storm god in a box. The Israelites settle into their new capital city. And according to the second book of Samuel, David, who's the leader now, he falls in love with this beautiful woman called Bathsheba. And he's spying on her while she's having a bath or something. And he immediately gets... he must have done more than just thrust inside her, pause, and then withdraw because he managed to get her pregnant immediately. Like, he called her to his chambers. He has intercourse with her. She's pregnant. The problem was she was already the wife of a really popular general who happened to be fighting a war for David in foreign lands.
Okay, awkward.
Now... at first, he tells the general to come home. He's like, oh, general, you should come home and see your wife, because he's trying to make
trying to set it up that the child will be his.
That in 9 months' time, it won't be suspicious. But the general writes back and he's like, my men are dying. I must stay here and fight. I cannot come back and lay with my wife. And David the king's like, oh, crap, what am I going to do now? So he basically...
conception.
he sends orders to the front line that this general needs to do this crazy, like, frontal attack into a blitzkrieg. And he basically orchestrates it so that the general dies in battle.
Oh.
And then he marries the chick. And eventually she gives birth to the child that eventually becomes King Solomon. So it's King Solomon... who would build what is probably, Knight and Butler right, the most famous temple in all of history. It's King Solomon's temple. Now, during Solomon's reign, he reigned for 40 years. He had a good time as a king. He surrounds himself with all kinds of luxuries. He has all kinds of grandeur, typical Canaanite monarch. He has a staggering 700 wives and 300 concubines.
That'd be exhausting.
Can you imagine the Viagra you would need just to keep up with that?
Or at least a lot of awkward standing around for 2 minutes.
Yeah, and there's no thrusting and pausing. No one's got time for that. So alongside his traditional Israelite devotion to Yahweh, the God in the box that's angry and
turns
people into flames, King Solomon worshipped a range of other gods. And this is starting to get into the thrust of what this book is about. King Solomon venerated a host of other deities. And the idea that this storm god in a box was the only god that the Israelites would worship hadn't taken root yet. It was still a polytheistic faith. So among the more unpleasant practices he embraced was the sacrifice of his own children to the god Moloch.
Oh.
So Moloch is an ancient Canaanite solar deity, and there's all these like modern conspiracies about, you know.
Well, you see that classic drawing of, you know, children being held up towards it and it being like a demonic and evil.
And it's probably a conspiracy somewhere that the globalists sacrifice to Moloch to this day. But back then it was considered a necessary process for Canaanites who wanted to be true kings to sacrifice their children to this god.
It's not worth it.
So this is in the Bible that King Solomon erected a temple for Moloch on the hill against Jerusalem. It was built, today it's called the Valley of the Children. That's what it translates to. And this practice of sacrificing the king's children would continue for hundreds of years. It was eventually outlawed, but that's a long time. And so Solomon and his government, they prosper. And eventually he enters into an alliance with this neighboring kingdom, with Hiram the First, the Phoenician king of Tyre. And and the king of Tyre assisted him in this extensive building work, which was the great temple where this angry storm god in a box would reside. So this is where we get into this whole idea of the Shekinah. And the Shekinah was this combining of stars, and it was considered a powerful sign and deity for the Israelites.
Do you mean it's like an astrological phenomenon?
Yeah, let me continue. I'll explain it in a moment. Essentially, the Ark of the Angry Storm God in the Ark of the Covenant was kept inside this temple. But when the temple was constructed, it wasn't just built for Yahweh. Because King Solomon worshipped all these other deities, he required a temple that connected with the gods. And this is where it gets MU, this story, because right now it's just been like Sunday school. he needed a kind of communication center that gave the ruler a conduit to the realms of the gods in the heavens. The key to such a building lay in an understanding of astronomy and most particularly the long-term movements of the planet Venus, which was the goddess Ashtoreth. Now, the goddess would also go by the names of Ishtar, Ashtar, Asherah. But Ashtoreth was connected to fertility, sexuality, war. It was connected to the planet Venus. And every 8 years, Venus returns to the same point in the sky. And then every 40 years, Venus completes a full lap of the zodiac. It ends up back where it started. So in traveling through the heavens, the planet appears to describe a five-pointed star around the sun. So that five-pointed star is the symbol of this goddess. And this is basically the pentagram that, you know, has existed throughout history. So for King Solomon, this cycle of Venus of precisely 40 years was of paramount importance. And he understood, like the kings before him, that every important aspect of life was governed by this cycle of Venus and its goddess. So this period of 40 years was considered divine. And you look through the history and everything's broken down in these cycles of 40 years. So Moses led his people through the wilderness for 40 years and from the age of 80, and then he died at the age of 120. So that's another 40 years. Throughout the Old Testament, God frequently allows the land to rest for 40 years. If the Israelites can do some massive sin, God punishes them for 40 years. Eli was the proto-king of Israel for 40 years. King David, Solomon's father, ruled for 40 years, so on and so on and so on. This 40-year cycle is critical to everything that happens at this time for these people.
Like the whole wandering through the desert for 40 years, is that the same thing?
It's the same idea, and it's all based on the cycle of Venus, according to Knight and Butler. Now, there was only one astral power that's greater in this pantheon of gods that's greater than Venus and greater than its 40-year cycle, and it's the Holy Shekinah. So the Shekinah is this star, this brilliant star that would appear in the sky every 12 Venus cycles. So every 480 years they would see this. So what is this Shekinah? Well, it's basically caused by Venus and Mercury rising in conjunction. And when you see it from Earth, they essentially overlap and it looks like a ridiculously bright star. So it's this massive event.
And what do you say this is every 480 years?
Every 480 years, so 12 cycles of Venus. So this appearance of the Shekinah, these, Mercury and Venus rising together and overlapping, it was a sign that for the Israelites, something major was about to happen. Like every time this occurred, every time this star, they called it, the Shekinah showed up, something insane would happen. And that would be amplified every third appearance of the Shekinah, which was every 1,440 years. Now, and that's another number that shows up in their previous books as being related to the yard and the cubit and all these measurements, and it's encoded in the Great Pyramid. Yeah. It's one of these weird holy numbers. And one such appearance of this Shekinah was due to fall at the winter solstice in 967 BC when King Solomon was in his reign. And he understood this because of his knowledge and because of the knowledge of his high priests. And what he wanted to do was to essentially clear the hilltop on the north part of the city. And it was like the perfect time to build this temple that would be a communications device with the gods. So it's this actual understanding that if you build this technology into this temple and through this angry sky god in a box, they've got this Egyptian box with this really pissed off god in there, it'll act as like a CB radio to the gods in the heavens as long as they build this temple right. So it's almost like they're building a giant antenna dish to speak to the gods.
And it's almost like as well that, because it's been described as being a power inside that ark as well. It was like a power source. So is that what's powering the communications array?
Well, if it's got the ability to turn someone that looks at it in an odd way into a ball of dust. And also,
I would say that's pretty powerful.
Bring down the walls of the cities of their enemies, then yeah, it's definitely a power source. So this date that it was is appearing was said to be precisely 1,440 years after Noah's Ark had come to rest on dry land. So everything is in this
these the same cycle,
cosmic cycles. Mm. Now this Shekinah, this merging of Mercury and Venus, was something greater than Yahweh. And it was greater than even Ashtaroth, the goddess of Venus, or any other single god in their pantheon. King Solomon understood that the light of the glorious Shekinah heralded the mating of the total Godhead with the entire world of men. It was the forces of God and goddesses merging as one. This was the entire world of humans linking with the realm of the gods. It was earth connecting with heaven. It was yin merging with yang. And this male shaft of light coming from this Shekinah in the heavens would penetrate the female soil of the earth and create abundance. And that's why you have stories of when the temple's constructed, you know, and everything that flows out of the temple, like immediately trees with fruit will just grow in a week and the entire land will be full of abundance. Everything grows magically around it. It's channeling some kind of cosmic energy and amplifying it somehow. And apparently he understood this. And the idea, like this idea isn't unique to this part of the world as well. They point out that since the 5th millennium BC, there's been temples that have been built to channel the light of stars and then penetrate them deep into the earth. I've been to one of them, actually. They point out that Newgrange in Ireland, which actually I think predates, like it's 2,000 years older than Solomon's temple. This is set up to do exactly that at the winter solstice, or every 8th winter solstice. So again, those divisions of 40 and 1440, the light of Venus penetrates through this hole that's set up in the construction and penetrates deep into the earth. It's like this was an idea amongst these ancient cultures that you would capture the energy from the stars and channel it somehow.
And there are a lot of locations around the world that have these very ancient sites that do line up with the stars, but to capture energy. I'm thinking even more recently though, Coral Castle. Coral Castle's got one of those weird peepholes that seems to align with a certain astrological phenomena.
Is that what he was doing, capturing the energy?
Yeah, was he capturing the energy? Is that what he utilized?
But Solomon's motive, King Solomon's motive, was more complex than simply building this temple to you know, put Yahweh in there and channel this light. Again, the idea that they're arguing here is that it was a kind of a machine. The temple was a machine to produce a response from this light, from the Shekinah. It was a carefully constructed mechanism that would act as a conduit to all the gods, a kind of, they actually use the term, telecommunication center between mankind and the realm of the divine. And again, the idea that this would connect him to the gods through the use of Yahweh, this angry god in a box, this is what he was trying to do. Now, the only problem was he had no idea how to build this temple. His priests didn't know. He didn't have this knowledge that was required. So that's why he reached out to Hiram, the king of the neighboring Phoenician city-state of Tyre. It's probably Tyre. It's T-Y-R-E. Tyre.
Yeah, I think Tyre. I could be wrong.
Tyre. Tyre? I'm saying Tyre. I'm going to say Tyre.
Well, you said Sinai as well, isn't it Sinai?
Yeah, that's what I said, Sinai.
Oh, I thought you said Sinai before.
I'm so tired, dude. I've read so many Birdman stories today. I'll go back and forth. Anyway, they reach out to Hiram, the king of the Phoenicians, and essentially King Solomon says, look, I'm going to give you all of this stuff, all this oil, corn, wine, grain. I'm going to give you all this stuff.
Abundance.
And you've got to give me one of your high priest engineers. So Hiram, this was a sweet deal for him. So he's like, fine. So he gives in this guy, whose name is Hiram Abiff. He's a high priest and he's a stonemason. And with him, he has a team of stonemasons who are also high priests that are going to build this thing. And they have this secret knowledge that's been kept, you know, within their cult for thousands of years. So with the aid of this Hiram Abiff, this stonemason, the foundations for this new temple are laid in 967 BC. Now, here they point out that the location that the temple is built is obviously not an accident, but the location of Jerusalem is not an accident either. It's like it's selected for a very specific reason. And I guess the idea...
Because it aligns with these constellations? Or
well,
these?
Jerusalem's 31 degrees, 47 minutes north, they point out, which means that the angle of the shadows cast by the winter and summer solstices is exactly 60 degrees. Like if you went anywhere else, the angles would be slightly different.
So now, what importance does that have?
Okay, so to see the importance of this, if you draw a circle on the ground and then you place a vertical stick in the east of the circle and then you place another vertical stick in the west of the circle, on the morning of the winter solstice, this stick on the east side of the circle will cast a shadow 30 degrees north of center. And then that evening, the westerly stick will cast a shadow 30 degrees south of west. And then you'll have the reverse for the summer solstice. So eventually what this means is once you've got all the winter and summer solstice casting these lines from these sticks, you have the six-pointed star.
Oh.
Like it's a perfect six-pointed star. It's the seal of Solomon. It's the Star of David. You know, what you see on the Israeli flag, that's where the symbol comes from. So it's a heavenly symbol.
Mm.
It's a symbol of the cosmos. Like a solar diagram is a better description. And the Israelites expected the Phoenician craftsman, Hiram Abiff, to not only build the temple, but they wanted this guy to explain the secrets of astronomy and the rituals required to make it work as a machine that connects them to the gods, mm-hmm. as an actual kind of communications device. Now, the Old Testament, it doesn't elaborate on the details of the construction, but Knight and Butler point out that the oral traditions of Freemasonry do. Now, the reason this whole book came about is because Christopher Knight is a Freemason, or he was a Freemason. And he said when he was initiated into the third degree, there's a ritual you have to go through, an initiation ceremony, where you're essentially roughed up a fair bit. Like he remembers kind of getting bonked in the head, like blindfolded, cracked in the side of the head, and then pushed to his feet, and then cracked onto the other side of the head, and then pushed down, and then pulled up, and then cracked again for the third time in the head. And then the blindfold was taken off, and the light came on, and he was told to look at some old bones. And after
you had to be dedicated.
Well, after he went through all this is only the third degree. He goes through all this, and he's, you know, having drinks, and he's welcomed into the third degree, and he's getting all chummy with his fellow Freemasons. And he asks a few of them, what did all that mean? Like, what was all the, you know, bonking me on the head? And what was the meaning of all of that? And no one could tell him. No one knew.
Mm.
It's just, I don't know, it's what you do for the third degree. So he wanted to figure it out. And that's why this research started. That's how this research came about, to actually figure out where this comes from. And through their research on their other books, he eventually noticed that some of the Masonic rituals seem to refer to events around this time period of like 900 BC with King Solomon. So in these traditions of Freemasonry, they describe events surrounding the building of King Solomon's temple, and it does it in considerable detail, they point out. And the rituals have been shown to contain knowledge, he says, that shouldn't have been available to a modern organization. Like Freemasonry's relatively modern, like it's 550 years old at best guess. But this is stuff that's thousands of years ago. So how is it that it's only in Freemasonry and it's not in the Bible? It's not anywhere else. It's just been hidden in this secret society.
Well, that's the word, right? It would suggest that it's been knowledge which has been retained but hidden by a special group.
Yeah. So in this third degree ritual where he's bonked on the head three times, it's said that King Solomon, King Hiram, and the Master Mason who's building this temple are the three grand masters. And this suggests that in this ancient time, they all held rank in some kind of secret order. They were all part of a secret society. And this is somehow some strand of it, some branch of it, some little essence of it has ended up in Freemasonry today.
But not the actual knowledge.
So they didn't get it. They'd just gotten the ritual, but not the purpose behind it.
They've got the surface of it. They're said to have met in a secret chamber directly below the Holy of Holies, which is the temple, the inner sanctuary, where the Ark of the Covenant stood with the angry God inside. This subterranean chamber was connected by a passageway to Solomon's palace. And according to Masonic lore, when the temple was nearly complete, 15 of those senior Israelite builder priests who were acting as overseers, they started to worry because they realized, oh, this temple's nearly finished and we've got no idea how this master builder has done any of this. Like, we don't know the final secrets. And they decided to obtain them by any means possible, even through using violence. Now, essentially, there was a plot to ambush him, to ambush Haram, the priestly builder. And 12 of the 15 Israelite masons were like, no, this is not good. This is too risky. I'm out. But three of them went ahead with the plot. And basically, they concealed themselves in the temple and they waited because he would come inside the temple and venerate the sun god like every evening at the same time. And the first priest jumps out of the darkness and confronts him and says, reveal the secrets of the temple or I'm going to bonk you. And he had a plumb rule as a weapon. And he demanded the secrets of this master mason. And Haram Abiff says, no, like, what I know, only three of us in the world know. It's that secret.
Three.
There's only three of us in the world that have this knowledge. And I can't betray the other two and reveal it to you. You'll have to kill me. So the first Israelite is like, boom, bangs him in the head. And he kind of stumbles over. And then the second guy jumps out and is like, tell us the secret or you're going to die. And whacks him in the head. And then finally, the third guy jumps out and again demands that Haram reveal these secrets to the temple, which is a communications machine with the gods. And again, he refuses and he's struck that third time. And the third time is a fatal blow. And that is why there is this getting your head crushed in when you're the third degree mason.
But what does it achieve?
Well, it's essentially...
I mean, it's obviously a ritual.
It's recording history. It's recording history and ritual. But they killed him. And they look at each other and they're like, oh, crap, what have we done? So they grab the body, they wrap it up in whatever, in tarp or something, and they put him in the back of their station wagon. They drive out to the New York River and they dump him in to sleep with the fishes. And then they flee into the mountains. Like, they're terrified of what's going to happen. So long story short, King Solomon obviously finds out that his master mason is missing. They find the body of Haram and they eventually capture these three guys. Apparently some guards were going past a cave and they heard the three dudes sobbing inside because they realized how badly they'd screwed up and they got captured. So he puts them to death and the temple was eventually completed. But it's explained in this Masonic ritual that the secrets were lost. The secrets were never passed on. Like, the Israelite builders never got it. Even down to today, the knowledge is gone. So where does this go? The temple's built. It does act as this kind of magical device. King Solomon holds a council of all the priests in his land. And he now decides that all beliefs and gods are part of a whole single truth. However many names are given to the gods, he declares there's a singular truth, there's only one divine presence despite all these many manifestations. He is she is him, and the light of Shekinah is the true light of all truths. What King Solomon said was that all of the gods are just fragments of a whole singularity that is the one and only divine. Solomon's deepest respect was for the traditions of Enoch, they point out. And according to ancient tradition, Enoch was on earth almost 2,000 years before Moses was born. And there seems to be, you know, they go into this whole thing on Enoch, which is beyond the scope of this show, but essentially, again, like a secret priesthood that goes back into the depths of time before there's any concept of Judaism. And the Masonic ritual tells how King Solomon decided to create a new kind of secret priestly order based upon the mysteries and rites of the Enochian priesthood. And their mission was nothing less than to bring about a new world order. The authors say this was to be a world where all gods were viewed as a part of the same. Quite simply, they say it appears that King Solomon invented the modern concept of monotheism. And it's all based on Yahweh.
This angry mountain god.
This angry storm god who turns dudes to dust if they look at him the wrong way, as essentially a supreme force, an amalgamation of every interpretation of the creative force. This new supreme deity is the god of modern Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The members of Solomon's priestly order were to be in possession of secrets that would be passed on from father to son. This priesthood was to be unseen to the common man.
It's a hidden secret group.
It's a secret society. Their mission was to build a world in which they would use their influence to ensure that all gods were honored to the glory of the ultimate Godhead. Their task was to unify the entire world in a single, peaceful, tolerant society where God ruled through the king, his regent on earth. And listen to this. They were to achieve their objective by any means, including the judicious use of money, political influence, and if all else failed, force.
Yes. How contemporary.
This is a conspiracy. This is a plot to control the world.
Well, surely they've died out, or is there a suggestion in this book that they're still going?
Well, the center of this new great order was to be Jerusalem. Now, Aaron, I know what you're thinking. This is not another Jewish trick, okay? I know what you're thinking. It's not a Jewish trick. This is a separate...
I didn't say that.
This is a secret group. It's not the Jews. They're involved, obviously.
Is it a secret group of Jews?
I'm not going to say no or yes. They are involved, but it's not them. So these priests, this secret society, was to become a hereditary priesthood. So it would be passed on from father to son through the bloodline, through generations. And 2,500 years later, this priesthood would continue its work under the guise of Freemasonry.
Oh.
So is
there like a hidden group within Freemasonry?
Yes, that's what you're getting onto. Yeah. It's not like the regular Joe Freemasons on the third degree getting bonked in the head. There is some kind of inner hereditary circle.
Yeah, the secret inner circle.
A bloodline that's been passed down. And according to tradition, Solomon made a seal that would be the mark of his holy task force, which so happens to be the Israeli flag. But it's not, I know what you're thinking. It's not the Jews. It's not.
Look, I'm simply laughing because there are a lot of outrageous conspiracy theories A lot of outrageous conspiracy theories that I don't indulge in, but
Don't misunderstand me.
When you hear stories like this, it kind of lines up sometimes. And you go, oh.
So this seal of Solomon was the seal of the force that would invest 3,000 years attempting to build this new Jerusalem, to unite the world under this one God where the center would be Jerusalem.
So it's not working very well at the moment.
Well, it's meant to create the ideal state, the ideal society across the entire planet, a new world order. The bloodlines that would carry this mission forward, this secret society, the name that it kind of translates to is Star Families. They're called the Star Families, the bloodlines of these ancient priests. And they would take their secret mission to the four corners of the globe. So that's the general setup of this grand conspiracy. So, I mean, what happened to King Solomon? So Solomon, he reigns for 40 years, of course, there's that number again. And after he dies, the country splits in half. There's civil war. There's now two Israelite kingdoms. There's Israel in the north. There's Judea in the south. And they're fighting each other all the time. Eventually, the northern kingdom gets stronger economically. It gets more powerful, greater than Judea. And eventually they basically fall into decadence, like both countries. It's said in Hosea 4, verse 1 to 2, there is no truce, there is no mercy, there is no knowledge of God in the land. There's cursing, lying, killing, theft, adultery have overflowed. Blood hath touched blood. What is blood hath touched blood? Is that like, well, is that incest?
Well, no, it's just intermixing, right? Like I would assume that it's, like, obviously the people that are in that circle, because it's following a bloodline, if it's mixed in with other people, well, then that's blood touching blood.
This isn't the people in the circle. This is everyone else.
Just in general. Oh, well, maybe they mean race mixing or something.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's blood hath touched blood. I think that's incest.
Really?
Like, yeah, that's...
Okay, well, that's bad.
The point is, it's basically, it's turned into a godless land.
It's a mess.
The kingdom of Israel starts to disintegrate. All these kings come in who just start killing each other. Eventually, the Assyrian king, Sargon II, he's like, easy target. He overruns the kingdom of Israel. And then in, I think, 580-something BC, the kingdom of Judah, the southern Israeli kingdom, they're taken over by the Babylonians. And all the Judeans are basically taken into captivity. They're taken to Babylon. And many of Solomon's secret chosen priesthood, this secret society, they flee. And guess where they go? Egypt.
Oh.
They all go to ancient Egypt.
And then that, seemingly technology kind of flourished there.
Well, yeah, I mean, the timing is, it's interesting. I don't know if the timing matches up, but that's a place where they could go, their knowledge could be safe. But essentially, Israelite independence had come to an end. In 538 BC, the Persian king Cyrus, he defeated the Babylonians. He tells the Hebrews they can go back to their homeland. He decrees that the Temple of Jerusalem will be rebuilt. But it's never rebuilt with the technology, with the machinations that it had before. It's rebuilt, I think, two or three times after this, but it doesn't have the original secret structure that enabled it to work. And of course, it doesn't have the Ark of the Covenant because that was stolen, as long gone. But this new province of Judea, it's now utterly dedicated to Yahweh, the angry storm god. And the Judeans, they set about purifying their religion. They start devoting Yahweh. They get rid of the other gods. They make it monotheistic. And I think it's these guys that start writing down what essentially becomes Judaism. This is how it kind of starts. 500 years later, it's around 8 BC, and the Shekinah is about to come back.
Remember? Oh, yes.
Mercury and Venus, the stars, this is about to appear in the sky. Basically, everyone with any kind of insider knowledge, unless you're a farmhand or something, they kind of know that this is coming, and there's a prophecy that it's coming, and the people are talking about it.
Well, it'd be expected to be exciting, wouldn't it? Because wouldn't it have the idea that it's going to bring abundance?
Yeah, and they know it's about 960 years since King Solomon first built the temple, and it's exactly 1,440 years since Moses led his people through the Red Sea. And it's this special time when possibly a new Moses will step forward and lead them against their oppressors. And their oppressors at this time are, of course, the Romans. Now, Herod the Great is the king of this region at the time, but he's basically a Roman puppet. He has the temple rebuilt, and, the locals hate him. Like, the people don't like him because he's just a Roman stooge. But the work on this new temple is conducted by the stonemasons, who are also priests, just as it was in Solomon's time. And these priests are the ones who have kind of kept this bloodline going, this secret society. They're the ones who are rebuilding the temple. Now, the king, King Herod, like everyone else, he knows about this star prophecy. He knows that it's coming. Obviously, this prophecy is linked to a coming Messiah. And Mercury and Venus do happen to be in perfect conjunction. They shine like a beacon in the sky over Jerusalem, and it's shortly before dawn on the 21st of December. And you're like, well, hang on a second. I thought it was meant to be the 25th of December.
Wasn't that date actually contentious anyway?
Well, we'll come back to that. And they start talking, of course, about Jesus Christ, because this is obviously the new Messiah, as you all know. And it's interesting because Knight and Butler have a few differences with the official story. It's traditionally taught that Jesus was a carpenter, like his father. But they point out that the original Greek word used in the New Testament Gospels was tekton, which means simply craftsman, but its most usual use is a master builder working in stone.
Oh, a mason.
So Jesus was a mason. And if the priestly and Davidic bloodlines claimed for Jesus in the Gospels are near accurate, he also would have been a priest. And he was likely one of the 10,000 holy men who came into Jerusalem to work as a stonemason on the new temple. So yeah, they point out that there's hardly any carpenters in Jerusalem at this time because most buildings weren't made of wood. So yeah, he was most likely a mason. He was most likely a priest. And the Gospels use the word rabbi and teacher multiple times to reference Jesus. And the equivalence of those words is basically senior priest. That's what he would have been. And it's said that, you know, strangers would walk up to him and ask him to cast out demons, heal the sick, settle disputes, for example. So they're saying, like, it's logical he looked like a priest. That's why they went to him, because he was obviously looked like a priest. He was a priest. He could do these things. So that's why they went to him. So what they essentially established, without spending too much time on it, is that you have to consider, they say it's more reasonable than not to consider that Jesus was the following: of a royal bloodline descended from David and Solomon. He was born at the moment that the Shekinah arrived, as predicted, exactly 1,440 years after Moses led his people through the Red Sea. The new Messiah, who was expected to become the king of the Jews and lead an uprising against the Romans, that's who he was, and a high-ranking priest who worked as a stonemason on the new temple. But a priest of what, exactly? Yes, we know there's this secret kind of society that kept this knowledge. Well, there was a group of unique people that existed during this time that aren't mentioned in the Bible at all. The Greek historians write about them, like Pliny the Elder and all those guys, not mentioned in the Bible. It's kind of weird. It's a bit conspicuous in their absence. They refer to themselves as the followers of the way. And John the Baptist and Jesus were part of the same movement. They were known as the Essenes. The Essenes were a highly religious Jewish brotherhood who differed greatly from mainstream Judaism. The most fundamental difference was they structured, their entire calendar was different. Like, they structured it around the movements of the sun, whereas like mainstream Jewish practice, it was all around the moon. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes referred to themselves as the sons of light, the pure of mind, the followers of the way, while their enemies were described as the sons of darkness. Their teachings were concerned with the love of God, love of virtue, and love of one's fellow humans. And again, though, this group, not mentioned in the Christian Bible, not mentioned in Jewish religious writings.
So they only show up in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
They're in the Dead Sea Scrolls and, like, ancient Greek historians, other
that's what I meant.
Prominent writers like of the period. Like, we know about them, but conspicuously missing.
Yeah.
Why? Well, it's an odd omission, and these guys were like monks, like really kind of pious. They remind me of Eastern monks in a way. They rejected slavery. They believed in brotherhood. They weren't interested in philosophy in general, but only morals. It was all morals. They returned from work rejoicing as if they'd been partying all day, and their contentment of mind was the greatest of riches to them. Their members were instructed in piety and holiness. Philo wrote about their benevolence. They had no wish to possess worldly objects. They were passionate about cleanliness. They would wash in cold water, and they would wear pure white garments.
Very monk-like.
They prohibited swearing. They prohibited the taking of oaths other than the membership of their own group. And they rejected participation in trade or commerce. So they couldn't even, it's like they had no possessions. They had
no ability to acquire them.
Couldn't collect money. They were just basically kind of, they were just like monks. And it's recorded that they drew their recruits from the ranks of those who had renounced material things. But their main method of growth was adopting children.
Hmm.
And there's this quote attributed to Jesus in Luke 18:16, where it says, "But Jesus called unto them and said, suffer little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God." So what the authors are saying, that's him actually saying, well, you can come and join our society. You can come and join our order.
Oh.
It's not like, I mean, obviously that's interpreted as you coming into the kingdom of heaven and you're going to be saved and blah, 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 which, you know, still could be true. But he's saying you can come and join our order and, you know, shave your head and give up all your possessions and you're becoming a monk, basically.
And you're in the inner fold then.
Yeah. The historian Philo tells us that these holy people devoted all their attention to the study of morals, using as instructors the laws of their country, which would have been impossible for human minds to devise without divine inspiration. So there's a hint that they have some kind of scientific, mathematical, hidden knowledge that other people don't have. And he also said, this historian said, the seventh day for them was very holy.
Hmm. For the Sabbath.
Yeah, they didn't marry, so they were pretty much celibate. Very strict rules about sexual intercourse. They regarded all pleasure as the devil and disciplined themselves in complete self-control. And again, remember they wore white robes? They referred to themselves as the Lebanon, which in Aramaic means the white. So they're just all...
So is that white as in light?
It's like... Well, no, it's just like in white robes. It's like those stories of people who, you know, climb Mount Shasta and the weird glowing man in white comes down from the mountain. It's like this is what these guys would look like. And essentially, this is what they took as a vow. Piety towards God, pretty obvious. Justice to all men. Fidelity to all men, especially those in authority. Perpetually lovers of truth, the cultivated truth, and above all, keep their doctrines secret. So what Knight and Butler are saying is that the Essenes were the surviving star family priesthood that was formed by King Solomon. This is the form they took.
And what do we know of them today? Have they somehow...
I don't know.
...continued to persist?
Well, this is their broader argument that, yeah, they exist in secret societies throughout time and eventually maybe a shadow of them has existed in Freemasonry or an inner core like you were pointing out. They consider themselves to be the elect of God.
Well, I don't like the whole through force thing.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Like, it all sounds very pious, but then it's like
you can't beat people into your will.
Unite everyone through force to observe the same God. Okay.
Well, it sounds very Hitler-esque in a way, doesn't it?
So very peaceful people are also very much ready to go to war. They believe that they were the sons of light and everyone else, including the Jews around them, were the followers of the moon. They were the children of darkness. They were born of falsehood. And essentially, they believe that there was an opposite to their Yahweh, this singular God, and that was Satan. And they needed to go to war. They needed to go to war and their God would back them up and they would defeat their oppressors, who were the Romans.
But any God that smites someone simply for not looking at it the right way is probably not a benevolent God.
No, I think that's pretty based. I think
no, it's just cranky.
Turning someone into a puffy ball of dust for giving you a smirk when there shouldn't be a smirk. Very based. So... Jesus, who's the leader now of this secret society, I guess you can call him because they keep their inner belief secret, he knows that it's time to go to war and he's got God's authority. He knows he doesn't have many troops, but he's going to take on the Romans, and because they have the Shekinah, the light of God behind them, they're going to win. And they totally failed. Obviously, it wasn't meant to be.
Well, we all know what happened.
The Romans arrested him, called him a terrorist as soon as he went public. He was executed with little delay. And the leadership of the Essenes went to Jesus' younger brother, James, according to the authors. Now, life went on for them after Jesus was crucified. And the authors, Knight and Butler, they have a section where they dispute the resurrection. They say that that isn't a true account of history, and they explain where it comes from later. So life went on, and, you know, James, the brother of Jesus, is leading this group. And then this stranger arrives in Jerusalem just a few years after Jesus had been crucified. He's from Tarsus, which is the capital of this area in Asia Minor. And his religion is Mithraism. It's like a Persian sun worship, right?
Oh, but there's that sun worshipping thing again.
And this guy, he's born to this Mithraic couple who had converted to Judaism. And so he's a Greek speaking, these are Greek speaking Jews. They give their son a Hebrew name and a Greek name. And his Greek name is Paulos. So it's Paul. Now, this guy was a beefcake. He was strong. He was big. His trade was tent making, huge arms, big, strong guy. But he also had mental problems. Like, he was a bit wacko. And when he arrived in Jerusalem, he immediately got employment by the high priest of Jerusalem. And he essentially became a political enforcer to keep their religious opponents in place. And their religious opponents were this troublesome sect of Jews whose leader had recently been executed. He claimed he was the Messiah. So he's basically a strong man. He's beating up the Essenes, you know, he's stealing their robes, he's kicking them into the dirt, he's saying, you know, stay down, dogs. But one day on the road to Damascus on a mission to kick some ass, he suddenly has this mystical experience. And he feels like in this stunning blind moment of inspiration, he's unlocked profound truths and God has spoken directly to him and him alone. Now, people have looked, experts have looked at this episode in history and said, you know, because we know he had some mental problems that was mentioned, he's had some kind of epileptic fit.
Okay.
Whatever it was, it's caused this guy who's a tent maker from Asia Minor, it's caused him to create a new religion. And he, in this moment of inspiration, he believes that God has given him an understanding of Jesus's mission that's completely at odds with the Essenes and Jesus's brother James and what they actually follow and believe. And they're all still alive at the time. And this foreigner, this guy, he just proclaims that the God of the Jews has revealed the truth to him alone and that his mission is to spread the word to non-Jews. And he's going to win by any means available. Now, the Essenes and Jesus' brother James, they're like, who is this guy? What is going on? What is he talking about? Like, they're at odds with him immediately. This guy's an outsider. He doesn't have the faintest idea about what their inner teachings are, their core knowledge, their secret doctrine. He knows nothing of the Shekinah, the star cycles. He knows nothing about Jesus. All he has is information that's third hand. And this is a guy, this Paul is a guy that's looking for a cause, and he wasn't beyond rewriting the story of Jesus to suit his needs. And that's exactly what he does. But he's not very original. He basically retells the story of Mithra, which was the religion he grew up in Asia Minor. So what are the tenets of Mithraic belief? Mithra had been born to a virgin mother in a stable.
What does this sound like?
When was Mithra born? 25th of December, except it was 600 years earlier. He had died, he was killed, and resurrected at Easter so that he could act as a mediator between mankind and God on Judgment Day. This is Mithra. He just takes all that and he's like, oh yeah, that's Jesus. And I got this vision. This is the vision I had. Listen to me proselytize. So this entire fictitious account, obviously it outraged the Essenes, and there was these encounters between James and Paul. But this Paul, I mean, he was strong, he was wily, he apparently had personal charm. He knew the Roman world because the Essenes were basically like hermits who didn't trade. They had no money. They were poor by choice.
This guy, it seems like they have no power at all, and yet they want to take over with the use of force.
Well, they have secret knowledge, but they just kind of withdrawn from the world. And they don't have any influence, but Paul, he understands the Roman world. So he goes on a series of journeys and goes essentially across the Roman Empire telling this story. And he gradually creates what we call Christianity today. He spreads the word of a Jewish man God who had died and resurrected himself and who had then returned to heaven. His story was nonsense to the people of Judea, but the non-Jews of the Roman world identified with this theme that he was talking about because it was a familiar story. It was the story of Mithra. And after Paul had disappeared in Rome, the Gospels were later selected for inclusion in the New Testament, and they're all written by people in Cyprus, Egypt, Turkey, and Rome, by people who had never set foot in Jerusalem and by people who had heard that story that was spread by Paul. So isn't that fascinating?
It's crazy.
This alternative idea of, and the real core of what the religion was just kept in this secret society and as perhaps persisted secretly.
Mm. Within a secret group somewhere.
And this guy with mental problems became the progenitor of one of the biggest, most powerful religions in the world. So where does this all go? Who was this secret society? How did they evolve? And what's the connection with the Freemasons? In what forms did they exist in history? What is their secret knowledge? Did they retain it? Do they still know how to build temple machines that can communicate with gods? What does that mean if you can build that?
Yeah, and what are they talking to them about?
Where is the angry storm god that was trapped in the Egyptian box?
Powering a pyramid somewhere.
Is he still in there? That's why he's so angry. He's been trapped in a freaking box for thousands of years. All the answers, and when I say all, I mean some. And when I say most. Some, I mean just a handful, because I haven't finished the book yet, are coming up in our Plus extension. We're going to find out what happened to the temple. We're going to find out about the ultimate war with the Romans. We're going to find out about these star families and how they made their way into Europe. That's coming up after the break.
Also, don't forget, we're going to be checking out the Dreamscape Manipulators, the Crystal Meth Reptilian Connection, and the Guru with the Glowing Eyes.
I can't wait for that crystal meth story.
Oh, it's wild stuff. Yeah, it's very, very, let's just say it's on the very outer limits of being out there.
Is Nancy Pelosi's Kundalini involved?
I'm going to say yes.
That's been
I can't guarantee it, but I'm going to say yes.
That's been my artificial intelligence art prompt all day.
I know. I've been trying to read all day, and I keep on getting distracted by Pelosi AI jugs.
Because I had to turn off the fast rendering because it costs money, so I just put it on. There's a relaxed mode where you just run it in the background, and I just the prompt was Nancy Pelosi, giant chest, star woman from the Pleiades.
Did we either explain this to Plus members? Because if you're a regular listener, you've probably got no idea what we're talking about.
None of this doesn't matter. This is a Plus thing.
Join Plus to work it out.
It's a Plus thing. And then I had it emerging from a UFO with a galaxy background.
I liked that one.
And I would just run that on the AI.
Yeah, the one
and then
up.
I would just repeat it over and over and over. So I got about 100 variations of that.
And there's one I have to put in because essentially it's the most... let's say saggy person you could imagine, but her head is inside some weird box.
Well, this was the problem. I'm getting these AI images of Nancy Pelosi as like a star goddess from the Pleiades, and some of them just look too hot. Like there's some of them, it looks so horrible I can't even look at it, and the others are so hot I have to look at it. And there's hardly any in betweens that are the perfect image that I'm going for. So it's a work in progress.
Can I put a couple in the show notes?
Yeah, we'll talk about that after the break as well. That's all coming up in Plus. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. $9 a month. Help support your favorite show. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday. And of course, you get an exclusive show on Tuesday if you're a Plus member. Plus members also get totally ad-free versions of our podcast. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to everything we've done too. All the back catalog shows are available to MU Max members. Sign up today. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Stick around if you're on Plus. For everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us.